Welcome to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Sometimes a single name comes to represent a whole field of human endeavor. Think Einstein, Galileo, Shakespeare. In music, the name is Beethoven. Survey any group of people, ask them to name a single classical composer, and I would bet most of them say Beethoven. He is the namesake of a film starring a slobbering St. Bernard. The idol of Peanuts piano prodigy Schroeder. His works are sampled in everything from jazz to film soundtracks to TV ads. And for many people, Beethoven is the preeminent figure of classical music. How did he become so well known? And as the musical world reevaluates who it reveres, how do we put this towering figure into context? Those are two of our key questions today on Dialogue. And joining me to answer them are Lisa Musi-Eckhoff, the Executive Director of the Oak Ridge Civic Music Association. She joins us from Oak Ridge. Lisa, hello.
Good afternoon.
Garrett McQueen, a WUOT alumnus, a passionate advocate for increasing diversity in classical music, and co-host of the podcast Triloquy. Garrett, welcome back to WUOT.
Hey, y'all.
And Aram Demersian, another familiar voice, because he's a frequent guest on WUOT. He's the 8th Music Director of the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. Aram, welcome back.
Great to be back in, well, sort of in studio with you.
That's right, here in spirit, and we appreciate all of you taking the time today. Where I want to begin, of course, is with some primer on how Beethoven came to be Beethoven in all caps, this man that is so well known even 2 centuries after his life ended. What makes Beethoven's work so special that it would stand out both in his lifetime and in the years since? And Garrett, I think I'd like to begin with you because you have played all 9 of his symphonies.
I have, and maybe 2 of which under Aram's baton. So yeah, a nice full circle moment here. You know what I understand about the canon of classical composers as we discussed them. Many of them weren't so famous in their day, and their legacies have been blown up in a contemporary way. I think Mozart is a really great example of that. When it comes to Beethoven, he was very he was the talk of the town, so to speak, even during his day. There was a time when after his death, his legacy sort of began to fade, and later composers, one of which being Felix Mendelssohn, began to bring his works back to prominence. And that's when, Western Europe began to remember once again that Beethoven was this incredible composer during his day who wrote this incredible music. Of course, when the tradition crosses the Atlantic over into the United States, as it has, so did that legacy. And I think that's one of the big reasons why the name Beethoven is still to this day ubiquitous with classical music, so-called classical music, as I say.
Yeah. Aram, I want to turn to you as the person on the podium who studies these works as well. What is it that's special about the music itself? Beethoven obviously was not the only composer working during his era, but he was considered a revolutionary figure. Why is that?
Well, I think there are a few reasons. I mean, I think with any artistic figure and any art that becomes famous, there are at least a couple of things going on. There's the fact that the music really does resonate on a very elemental, visceral level with a larger proportion of people than most other artists or most other art. But then there's also the marketing campaign and the legacy making and the myth making, which we're going to get into. In terms of the music itself, Beethoven really was considered a revolutionary in his time in terms of how he expanded the scope of what was possible musically in a symphony, expanded the scale, expanded the length, expanded the emotional content, the weight and the percussive elements of the symphony. Personally, for me, what I think makes Beethoven a composer that people still gravitate toward is the fact that he composes in a way that allows his music to become familiar as you're listening to it. I think because of his repetitiveness, because of the compulsion of his writing, because of the rhythmic persistence of his writing, listening to any new piece of music, it can be intimidating because it could be unfamiliar to you. And Beethoven writes in such a way that as you listen to his music, it kind of becomes like a friend and you increasingly know where you are. And it can be a very satisfying experience to, any random listener.
And Lisa, I want to throw that question to you as well. What do you find special about Beethoven's work that would explain why he is held in such high regard, kind of above and beyond almost anybody else who's written music?
Absolutely. I find Beethoven to be so fascinating because he just comes across as a normal guy. We don't think of him necessarily as being a child prodigy, although certainly he was composing and studying and playing musical instruments at an early age, but we don't necessarily put him in that same category with some of those prodigies like Mozart and Schubert and Mendelssohn. And so I think the general public can sort of latch onto Beethoven and recognize that, you know, he had difficulties in his family growing up, and he had, I think, some social problems along the way. And then he came across with some illness and his hearing loss that put him just in a category that makes him feel very approachable to the regular person. And I think we all feel like there are aspects of his life that we can relate to and connect to. And I think that's one of the great reasons that Beethoven survives to this day, is that people connect with him, not only musically, but on a personal level as well.
Some artists, and Garrett, you alluded to this a moment ago, some artists are poorly recognized within their lifetimes and only kind of get recognition after their deaths. Some are famous during their lifetimes but then come kind of forgotten after they die. I'm kind of surprised to learn that Beethoven ever experienced like that cyclical kind of flagging of reputation or renown, but you indicated that that did happen at least briefly, and then he kind of surged back into popular culture. Could you tell us a little bit, like, what was it that that happened that changed that? Beethoven dies, his works maybe become a little bit less well-known, and then they're resurrected. How did that happen?
Yeah, and I'm sure Aram can help me a little bit with this. You know, his symphonies have always been seen as just these pillars of the repertoire. You go up as late, get into the 19th century, and talk about folks like Johannes Brahms, you know, who, you know, waited for decades to write that first symphony, you know, in light of, you know, the pillars that that Beethoven had built through his symphonic writing. But, you know, when I mentioned Mendelssohn earlier, you know, works like Beethoven's Violin Concerto, you know, were all but forgotten. And, you know, he went back and saw, you know, not only do we have these, you know, incredible symphonies, but we have this incredible catalog of so much more that exhibits Beethoven's excellence. There's been a time where Beethoven's one and only opera, you know, saw a renaissance. So, you know, I think, you know, my understanding of that situation, my short answer to that question is that, you know, the importance of the symphonies never went away, as much as Beethoven as this figure and this monumental music creator, how that faded. And then when you get into, you know, early to mid 19th century, you have folks like Mendelssohn saying, wait, this was a guy who was all around phenomenal. There's so much more than just, you know, the Fifth and Ninth Symphony that we all know and love.
Aram, any thoughts to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Garrett nailed it. You know, the sort of the man, the myth, the legend of Beethoven actually began during Beethoven's lifetime with some of the things that were written about him. I mean, there's a very well-known, very romantic, almost poetic review written by E.T.A. Hoffman of the Fifth Symphony, where you can hear all of this, you know, all of this glorified language that's used to talk about Beethoven. But then some of that legend, as Garrett was saying, in terms of the significance of the symphonies, was carried on by both Beethoven's contemporaries, his fellow composers, and the composers that followed him. Garrett mentioned Brahms and Mendelssohn. There was also Schumann and, you know, Schubert, who was a teenager, who was even present at some of the premieres of Beethoven's symphonies. And Beethoven really was this intimidating figure, this heavy figure that sat on the shoulder of anybody that followed him. And there was a strong element of just sheer musical respect for what Beethoven was able to do on the part of the composers that followed him. And as you got into the latter part of the 19th century, and a century which was, there was a burgeoning German nationalism movement over the course of that century, you start to see composers like Wagner and like Liszt purpose Beethoven's legacy and connect it with nationalism in some ways that became destructive and, you know, over the course of the century that followed. And you know, as Lisa was mentioning, Beethoven is such a fascinating historical figure. One of the both benefits and drawbacks, I would say, to that is because he had such a rich personal history, he can kind of be whatever you want him to be, depending on what part of that history and what part of his personality you're drawing on.
I want to turn to Lisa to begin this, but maybe get some feedback from perhaps all three of you on this. I want to bring a name into the conversation, Anton Schindler, who purported to be some close contact of Beethoven's and published a biography after Beethoven's death, held a lot of the notes that Beethoven left behind. Is he a chief reason why Beethoven is still well known? What role did Mr. Schindler play in our current understanding or the mythology of Beethoven, Lisa?
Well, I think that all of the biographers who knew a composer or a musician firsthand, they are the ones that we can fall back on. Certainly their writings will give us a true up close and personal. They may be biased on some level in how they portray a figure, but certainly when we have writings like that, we can, as Aram was saying, we can draw from that what we feel we need to draw from and connect in ways that are best for us. It may not be the same for the three of us on the panel here or anybody. We're all coming from different perspectives. And so that helps us, those writings help us connect in ways that are meaningful to us.
Garrett or Aram,
I think, you know, the key word that Lisa said there was perspective. So when it comes to the work of Schindler, from the academic perspective, that is one of the principal resources that are there. But, you know, Aram spoke to Beethoven's music growing to represent a force of nationalism and identity across Europe. You know, it's that real world application that I think sits equally to the work of Schindler. You know, there's the famous story of Beethoven stripping the dedication from his Third Symphony because Napoleon crowned himself Emperor of France, if I have that correct. You know, that's a part of the real world. We learn about Napoleon in our history classes, and with somebody who was as famous as Beethoven was having a connection to that story, you know, there's no way to not really acknowledge it. So yeah, the work of Schindler, I think, is really important on the academic side of things. If I had to sit down and write a paper, maybe I would go there. But not to diminish, you know, his role in Beethoven's legacy. But I think it's so important to understand that sits alongside so many of these other real world applications that have served as a catalyst to Beethoven's fame over the centuries.
All right. Well, we'll take a station break now. We're going to continue our discussion in just a few moments. We're talking about Beethoven's legacy and his context in the modern musical world. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Our topic today is Why Beethoven? We're joined by Aram Demersian of the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra, Garrett McQueen, formerly of WUOT, co-host of the podcast Triloquy, and Lisa Eckhoff, the executive director of the Oak Ridge Civic Music Association. We want to hear from you as well. We have a couple of tweets and Facebook posts where you can respond and ask your questions online. Just go to facebook.com/WUOTFM, respond to the post on that page, or find us on Twitter at WUOTFM. Before the break, we were talking about who is shaping Beethoven's reputation and fame after his death. I mentioned Anton Schindler. Are there other names that are prominent in giving us the mythology of Beethoven as we understand him today? And that can be open to anybody.
I'll jump in there just really quickly. So, you know, folks who are familiar with my work know that I really center the intersection of race and classical music. One of the first things that I explored as a student on that topic was Beethoven's relationship with a man named George Bridgetower. So, you know, the Cliff's Notes is that Bridgetower was this black violinist who premiered one of Beethoven's works. After the premiere, they got into an argument over a woman, and like the Third Third Symphony, Beethoven stripped the dedication from there and dedicated it to a man named Rudolf Kreutzer. So I bring up that example of George Bridgetower just to, you know, reiterate the point that I was making before the break. With Beethoven being such a massive figure who has connections to so many other peripheral conversations and historical facts, it's hard not to see him, you know, as important as the world sees him today. You know, I guess that's my example there.
And I would say, you know, as we listen to Beethoven in our time now, as much of a nuanced conversation as we're having about him, you know, it's almost, you can't really separate completely your experience of the music all by itself from the legend, you know, and from the historical significance of Beethoven. I mean, it's just, you know, if you're really honest with yourself, I don't think it's something that you can do. I would say when you consider Beethoven in the context of the, you know, Garrett, I'm like you, I don't love to use that classical music terminology, but of the symphonic culture, we'll say, here in America, you know, that was a culture that was imported to a certain extent. I mean, Beethoven, by the time orchestras were being formed in both, you know, historically major cities in this country, but also 20th century industrial cities in this country, he was very much well established as a cultural icon in Europe. And the mostly imported conductors from Europe, many of them were of German extraction. They were the people that American philanthropists who wanted to sort of establish a culture and even a cultural elitism, you might say, in their own cities, brought over these conductors who held Beethoven in very, very high regard. And that elevation of Beethoven became one of the foundations of the symphonic music culture here in the United States, to the extent where there are some concert halls, including the concert hall in Boston, which is the city where I grew up, where there is an actual bust of Beethoven's face elevated, you know, many, many feet above the stage with the name Beethoven, almost in a pseudo-religious way.
And I would add to that, Aram and Garrett, that, you know, any executive director will probably tell you, as long as tickets are selling, we will keep playing Beethoven and performing his music. And so, Aram, you were talking about in today's world how he was sort of set up on a pedestal when music came to America. Certainly, we're continuing that pedestal here today, just by acknowledging the anniversary of his birth. And of course, organizations around the world are celebrating in a variety of ways, and they celebrate on occasions that are not necessarily big birthday years. So it's again, it's that fascination with him and the fact that the tickets will sell to these events. And so we're part of that, keeping him alive.
Absolutely, we are. And I mean, you know, definitely in my programming, I've taken advantage of the 250th year. The philosophy that I've tried to keep with myself as much as possible in terms of programming Beethoven also, and this is where you bring your different perspectives, like we've talked about, is, I mean, there are so many pieces of Beethoven that I absolutely love. I'll also say that just because Beethoven wrote it doesn't necessarily make it good, and doesn't necessarily mean that you have to think that it's good. So for Beethoven, as with any other composer, it's got to be a piece of music that I believe in and feel like I can make a case to for the audience. But also, because Beethoven, in terms of a box office, like you were saying, Lisa, is such low-hanging fruit in a way, I feel like if you're going to program Beethoven, don't waste it. Program Beethoven along with something else that you can draw genuine connections to and open up your audience members or your listeners' eyes to an area of music that they may not necessarily have had as much of an awareness of as they have of Beethoven.
Well, that gives me the entry to my next question, which is, if it is possible to define such a thing, and I know this is a subjective question with subjective answers, is it possible that his legacy is too large? In other words, that his slice of the spotlight is maybe larger than it should be and maybe pushes other people out? Or is it that kind of environment? You know, it may not be a zero-sum kind of situation. If you want more spotlight, maybe have a bigger spotlight. Is it possible that his legacy is too large? And Lisa, we can begin with you on that.
I'm really stunned thinking about the idea that somebody can be too large for the room. In a musical setting, there are, we could go back to Johann Sebastian Bach and maybe say the same thing in terms of the impact that he has had on Western music, choral, orchestral, symphonic, instrumental throughout our history. And I think sometimes it takes someone that large in the room to really propel new ideas and get people inspired to do things. So I'm not sure that I would say that his legacy is too large. Sometimes we talked about marketing and whatnot, and maybe we make that legacy feel especially large, but I'm not sure that he actually has a legacy that's too large to not be, to find other composers from different times, different countries, different places, different cultures, to be included in the mix.
Lisa, I think you're hitting on the point there. You know, it's not necessarily that his legacy is too large, but the celebration of that legacy. You know, something that's not subjective. You know, hard facts we have. I want to shout out Rob Diemer. He runs the Institute for Composer Diversity. A guest on my podcast. He has compiled data, and he took American orchestras in the season of, I believe it was the 2019-2020 season, went through everything that they were playing. The number of pieces of music that orchestras were playing by women and by composers of color did not match the number of pieces by Beethoven that orchestras were playing. So, you know, just so that the listeners, you know, really understand, so that it's crystal clear. In 2019, orchestras were playing more music by Beethoven than all women composers and all composers of color. That's data that we have. So when we talk about Beethoven's legacy, you know, it's a thin line between celebrating the lofty figure that he, you know, unequivocally was, while leaving room for the conversation of so-called classical music and the orchestral experience to continue. So, you know, while, you know, we celebrate Beethoven for who he was, and who he still is in many ways, there's so much more out there. And I think that's where institutions really need to take the conversation next.
Aram, what do you think of that?
I couldn't agree with Garrett and Lisa more on both of what they were saying. I mean, Garrett, that statistic that you said, I'm very familiar with the Institute for Composer Diversity. I was not familiar with that specific statistic, but I'm also, you know, I'm also not surprised by it at all. I mean, you know, orchestras and large institutions the world over have a lot of work that they need to do. And I include my own institution that I lead, and, you know, the programming that I do in other places, I include in that comment, have a lot of work to do in terms of making what is on our programs and who is on our stages look and sound and feel more like the world that we live in. And I'll add who is in our audience and the way we're interacting with them as well. It's a conversation that I think we are as a field collectively late to, and it's a conversation that needs to be at the front of mind consistently in all the decisions that we make.
One of the reasons we're having this conversation today is, as we are talking about and alluding to here, there are firmer calls, more persistent calls for diversifying not just pieces that are played, but the composers and artists that are in the public spotlight. And so one thing that I always kind of want to try to understand, because I'm only in my mid-30s, I certainly wasn't around in Beethoven's time, is this a genuinely new conversation that we are really taking a fresh look at the scope of how much Beethoven is being played, how big the footprint is within the cultural world? Or have there been arguments in the past about the size of Beethoven's renown? Have there been people in previous decades that have said, maybe we need to shrink the pie slice that he occupies here? Or is this really new to our time? Garrett?
It's a new conversation for some, I would say. Aram already said that, you know, classical music as an idea is late to this conversation. But even within, you know, the orchestral world, there have been people who have really challenged that status quo. Right now, I'm co-authoring a book that explores famous musicians who use their fame for activism. One of the people that we're profiling is a conductor named Robert Shaw. You know, so, you know, while he has many incredible Beethoven recordings, he knew that in a city like Atlanta, he needed to do so much more. So, you know, he was in, he was at Morehouse, he was at Spelman, he was programming the Negro spiritual. So, and that's just one example. There are folks in the past within the institutions that have engaged this conversation. But like I said, to, you know, begin my response, it's not a new conversation. Unfortunately, it's a new conversation for many, especially in classical music.
Mm-hmm. Aram, you alluded to this a moment ago, and this is a question I think all three of you face in each of your capacities right now. We can acknowledge that, yes, orchestras need to do a better job, or classical music recording studios that release CDs and make the nice-sounding formal recordings need to do a better job of diversifying selections, and I know many orchestras are doing that in earnest. But I wanted to ask a question about the how. So we acknowledge there's a what that needs to happen. How do you do that? How do orchestras better contextualize, say, Beethoven's work, or put it into perspective as part of this much larger genre and one that continually builds, as we say on the Composer's Datebook here on WUOT, all music was once new. So as new music joins the fray as well, how do you contextualize it? How do you give Beethoven his due without pushing everybody else out? And Aram, we can begin with you, because I know that's part of what you do is help make these program selections for the Knoxville Symphony.
Sure, that's a really good question. And I'll preface everything that I'm going to say in that I don't necessarily have the surefire answers to that question. Mm-hmm. And so I can, you know, this is going to be my perspective, and it's only one perspective. What I would say is a couple of things. I think as programmers and as conductors especially, and I would extend this to all performers who have programming related responsibilities, is nurture your curiosity about the music that you don't know as energetically and intensely, if not more energetically and intensely, as you nurture your curiosity about the so-called canon, in air quotes, the music that you already know that you're somehow supposed to know, because, you know, it's an indisputable fact that, you know, there's a lot of music that by composers who historically have been underrepresented on programs, who are underrepresented now, and there are so many living composers right now, it's virtually impossible to have an encyclopedic knowledge of all of them. But to come at it with an awareness that there's more that you don't know than that you know. And in terms of familiarizing yourself with music by composers of color, with music by women, with music by composers who are not necessarily at the forefront of the history textbooks, it's a practice like with anything else. And my experience at least was, and is, when you start that exploration, you're not necessarily going to know where to look. And then as you find more and more resources, you learn how to follow one resource to another, and you are exponentially expanding your repertoire the more time you are spending on doing that research and doing that listening. And it's something that with any practice has to be done consistently and persistently. And it is richly, richly rewarding. And I think it is to the benefit of our listeners and our own benefit as performers to take that knowledge and you know, incorporated on our programs. You talked about Beethoven specifically. There are so many stories that we can tell with Beethoven, and you can, there are so many parallels that you can draw. And just, I think, being as honest about history as you can be in terms of drawing those parallels. At least that's what, that's my two cents.
And Lisa, I wanted to ask you too, because again, you're in charge of an organization that presents this music in East Tennessee. How is ORCMA approaching this question?
Well, I would say for starters, I'm not in charge of the organization, but we do have a fantastic group of board members there who they are an outgrowth of a long history of people in the Oak Ridge area who have been great supporters of symphonic, choral, and chamber music. And so this year, we are undertaking, of course, what a lot of organizations do every so many years is long-range planning. And it's an interesting time to be addressing that due to COVID-19 and trying to figure out how things will be changing on so many levels as we hopefully come out of this pandemic. And I love one of the things Aram said about nurturing your curiosity. And one of the things I think we can do to expand the idea of the curiosity of composers that you haven't performed or pieces that have not been performed is nurturing your curiosity about who a potential audience is and who are the people who are not in your hall and what might they be curious about and how can we reach them and their thought processes and come up with programming that is includes everyone. So we certainly keep Beethoven on the stage, but we have so many other opportunities to explore and open our minds with some curiosity to present other things. And I think one of the main ways to do that is with funds and money. I mean, and of course that's always a showstopper for a lot of folks as well. Where do you get extra money to do such a thing? But if you're committed to doing something, you find the way to do it. You find the funds, and it's not necessarily that you're taking extra money either. You find a way to work out your budget and your programming so that you can do what needs to be done. And hopefully you decide that it needs to be done now and not a process that takes 5 or 10 years to get to.
Okay, well, I'm going to pause us one more time for a station break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the broader conversation of diversifying classical music on and off the stage. That's as Dialogue continues. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Welcome back to Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Our topic in this edition, why Beethoven? The legacy and the changing world, cultural world, around this towering figure of symphonic music. I used Aram's terminology there instead of classical. I wanted to be hip. We are joined today by Lisa Eckhoff, the executive director of the Oak Ridge Civic Music Association, who joins us from that fair city. Garrett McQueen, a WUOT alumnus, co-host of the podcast Triloquy. He's on the line from Minnesota. And Aram Demersian of Knoxville Symphony Orchestra, who is here with us in Knoxville. As we go into this final third of the program, I want to talk about the broader conversation about diversifying program selections, the personnel who are playing on stage, the personnel who are making the decisions in the front offices. We talked about maybe some good ways to do it. Before the break, Lisa and Aram, you both talked about being intentional about it, taking it seriously, wanting to commit, and then following through with that commitment. Garrett, I kind of wanted to open up this third with you because I think you have some thoughts on this. What are some bad ways to do it? And what I'm talking about here is avoiding surficial changes or tokenism or empty promises. What are some bad ways that arts organizations, including public radio, should avoid in talking about diversifying the music and the people that we're featuring?
Yeah, I think one of the, biggest, air quotes here, bad ways or bad, you know, initiatives that we're seeing are rooted in something we were talking about earlier, this being a new conversation for so many people, this seeming like a trend, the fact that, you know, people have to publicly lose their lives, you know, to initiate some of these conversations. So, you know, when organizations and institutions approach me about this conversation of diversifying programming, you know, I look at the organization's history. What were they doing in the past? Was there any curiosity there outside of the canon that centered diversity that I can point to? I think so many institutions again are just reacting to this and trying to seem like, you know, they're in on the conversation instead of really going deeper and asking themselves certain questions. You know, why does the canon look the way it looks? Why does my orchestra look the way it looks? Why does this hour of programming sound the way it sounds? You know, I think if you really look at the historical and in many cases violent implications to those questions and the answers therein, you know, institutions can do a better job of really understand not only the importance of this, but why it must be done beyond just being a reaction to contemporary conversation.
And I wanted to ask a little bit about the personnel on stage, because I know, again, Garrett, you think about this a lot too, as a musician, but also as a program host. You've had a foot in both of these worlds. There is, and you might know the number better than I do, but according to a recent survey, the percentage of, like, black musicians in symphony orchestras around the country is in the single digits. It's somewhere around 4 or 5% of orchestra memberships. How can orchestras do a better job of recruiting and holding on to and encouraging those people, too, to come along and join an orchestra or choose a career in music in the first place?
Yeah, what I want people to understand about that statistic, if it's the one I'm thinking of from the League of American Orchestras, you know, that counts all people of color. So when we talk about black people in orchestras, it's a little less than 8%. I think 0.9 or something like that, maybe more than a single percent. So, you know, when it comes to, you know, making it seem like a welcome and affirming space, if a black person is the only black person in an orchestra, you know, there are certain experiences that person cannot share with their colleagues, you know, certain perspectives on the music that really can't be engaged in that non-diverse environment. So, you know, my opinion that many people see, you know, as radical when it comes to personnel on orchestra stages, in administrative offices and beyond, is to purposefully and intentionally hire diverse. You know, if I see an organization that has lots of people that look like me telling stories that I'm familiar with alongside others, that in itself is going to be more attractive to me than an organization where I have to be the one to initiate everything. Mm. So step one for I would say nearly all of these organizations is to look at your personnel and figure out how you can make it more diverse, and therein make it more welcoming to more diverse audiences, to more diverse applicants, and everything around that.
Lisa, I want to turn that question over to you as well. How, again, specifically getting in from away from the what and into the how are music organizations, and as you have conversations maybe with your colleagues in other parts of Tennessee or around the country, how do you plan? What are some concrete steps that can be used to broaden diversity and inclusion in terms of the people question here, musicians, boards of directors, the front office, conductors and guest conductors, things like that?
Yes, Garrett said something that's very right on point, which is to intentionally hire people. One of the things that always strikes me as interesting in this kind of conversation is that there is there are conversations going on around the country, and the focus is called, depending upon where you are, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And in other places, equity, diversity, and inclusion. So DEI or EDI. And I think sometimes we get bogged down in that word diversity or that word equity, and since we're starting there, we immediately have to have huge conversations, it seems, that are many times uncomfortable, and make it just an awkward process. And for me, I like to turn those around, and I like to start with inclusion, because if you start with including everyone as someone who, you know, can be a part of taking in the great music of Beethoven, or the great music of, say, Jesse Montgomery, a well-established young African-American composer, violinist, chamber musician. When we think about everyone being included in the mix, then I think we start off, it's much easier, I think, to go forward from there, instead of getting bogged down in, oh boy, what does diversity really mean? And mm-hmm. is it equity, or is it equality, or what are we trying to focus on? But if you think about inclusion as being your main focal point, I think we can get off the ground much easier and faster.
Sounds like what you're talking about is deeds beyond words, I think is what you're indicating there, right? That the actions is kind of where that lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Garrett, to bounce back to you for just a moment, because I didn't want to let the hour go by without having you talk to us a little bit about Triloquy. This is a podcast that you've been doing with Scott Blankenship, whom many of our listeners may know from American Public Media. Tell us a little bit about Triloquy, because these conversations happen a lot within that space.
Absolutely. So when I moved to Minnesota, you know, I'll quickly tell the story. I found myself taking public transit much more because my Mini Cooper doesn't like driving through 2 feet of snow every day.
So I don't either.
So spending more time in transit really centered me on the world of podcasts. And the ones that I really started to dive into and enjoy, they were having conversations that I felt like applied to the world of classical music, but I wasn't hearing those conversations in content or in media on a regular basis. So that's where I decided to create that show, you know, with the word trill being a musical term, but also sort of being a slang term for unapologetically real, you know, true and real, mm-hmm. next to the word colloquy or soliloquy, you know, the idea of telling stories. You know, you mash those together and you get Triloquy. The first season of that show was in conjunction with American Public Media since June 1st. Scott Blankenship and myself have been running the show independently, along with the help of our producer, Evan Clark. And what we basically do every week is take certain subjects, certain topics that apply to classical music, and sit it down next to other music and other conversations to sort of show people that this art form can live among everything else. One of the analogies that I often say is that during recess, there's a kid indoors playing chess named classical music. We're making him go play kickball with all of the other kids, like rap and jazz and hip hop and bluegrass.
Oh, fascinating. What kind of listener response have you gotten from it? Because you were saying the idea of this, the sort of the necessity that was the mother of the invention, was that you weren't hearing the kind of conversations you thought needed to be happening and wanted to listen to. So have you been hearing from other people saying, yes, absolutely, right on, this I've been wanting to hear this as well?
Yeah, the feedback has been phenomenal, especially mm-hmm. in the last 6 months or so. Many of the conversations we have actually inspire many of the guests. So someone will hear me say something or hear something from a guest, and they'll say, oh, wait, I believe in that too, and we'll have them on. You know, my quick example, the conversations we were having on Triloquy, specifically centering that phrase classical music, caught the attention of a woman who lives in the Bahamas who also has that argument and really vies for music of Caribbean composers and the mm-hmm. sound of steel pan as equally classical. So, you know, having that conversation apart from her inspired her to reach out to me, and she became a guest on the show. So, you know, in and outside of the project, the impact is huge. You know, I've been in collaboration with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra and the Minnesota Orchestra. There are schools in my hometown of Memphis that actually use transcriptions of opuses of the podcast for music education courses. The impact has been huge, and I'm really thankful to have the platform.
To take a look at the other side of that equation, though, and something you and Scott actually talked about recently is getting pushback on what you're talking about or how you're talking about it. I'm a baseball fan, and this summer, many baseball players, and in fact, athletes across professional sports, have been much more vocal and firm about talking about, say, the Black Lives Matter movement or, more broadly, racial injustice in America. There is a contingent of fans, though, who, it will not surprise you, they don't want to hear anything about that, because their attitude is, look, I hear enough about this on the news. I want to watch my baseball game or my football game in peace. And what they're doing is making an argument about escapism. I want one area that's just free from me having to think about all these nasty, uncomfortable things, in their view. When you and Scott Garrett talk about diversifying classical music, and you're blunt about it, you're frank about it, and about racism within the world of the fine arts, do you get that same pushback? Do you have people who say, like, ugh, can you just leave classical music alone? I just want to listen. Does that happen?
Yeah, there are two ways for me to address that. The more important one, I think, is the idea of escape. When we talk about black women and black men and black trans people living in the society that we're living in now, you know, there is no escape from some of those stresses and from some of that trauma. So the idea that classical music can be an escape for some people is just flat out offensive to me, especially considering that, again, as we've noted with Beethoven and many others, their music really has a connection to the world. You know, I can, Aram, I can throw you in here as well. You know, when we talk about challenging that status quo, challenging that escape space, that safe space. Maybe my last season with the Knoxville Symphony, we started with William Grant Still's First Symphony, and you know, you got in front of the audience to talk about that I Got Rhythm motif, that, you know, who stole it from who or whatever. You know, we classical music as it is, stories like that, you know, and don't let me put words in your mouth, Aram, but I do remember your approaching that with sensitivity, you know, and I think there is something there's a connection there with that safe space, that escapism, and the idea that even mentioning that someone like George Gershwin may have borrowed, again, air quotes, from a black composer is something uncomfortable for people to hear in that sort of space.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that was only my second Masterworks concert of my time with the symphony, and you know. Yeah, you know, it was 4 years ago. You go into any new community, you're not necessarily sure, you know, how your words from the stage are going to be received. And you and I had a conversation about a year later about, you know, how I sort of tiptoed right up to the issue, but didn't necessarily dive right into the heart of it, which is 100% true. And like what Lisa was saying, I think we all, but especially white people like me, need to get more comfortable with being uncomfortable and get a little bit more uncomfortable with potentially making other people uncomfortable. And that's something that, you know, I've been trying to get better at. I think probably Garrett, I would have handled that particular comment from the stage. I would like to think I would have handled it differently now than I did 4 years ago, hopefully as a result of trying to get more comfortable with being uncomfortable. And that's something for me personally that I'm always trying to keep in balance, which is to speak truth and bring as many people into that truth as possible.
Lisa, I wanted to ask you about kind of the same thing. Again, as someone who's involved with, you know, programming for a couple of music organizations in Oak Ridge, do you get that pushback? And if so, what do you tell people when you, I mean, what is it we get, I guess, is what I'm saying. When somebody says a complaint, you're like, okay, well, when we broaden the program offerings, when we broaden who's playing it, when we broaden who we're featuring, you get this in return. You get something greater. Is that what you generally kind of hold to these folks?
Definitely, I would say that you get a bigger audience. You get money. You get new people coming together with traditional audiences, which I think can just spur a whole new conversation in where we're going in this field. It's always interesting to me, if not just super exciting, when you see people coming from what we have determined to be from traditions and history. We see people coming from different ends of the spectrum, and all of a sudden they come together on some piece of art, whether it's music or painting, and they come together and can recognize that we're all on this ship together, so to speak. And
Lisa, thank you so much for that thought. We are out of time, unfortunately, but the conversation, of course, continues. Thank you so much, Lisa Eckhoff from the Oak Ridge Civic Music Association. Garrett McQueen, WUOT alum, thank you so much. Listen to his podcast, Triloquy, Arum Demersion of the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra. Thank you all for joining us, for everybody for listening. Greg Hill is our producer. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Thanks for listening to Dialogue.